This is a podcast from meow.net.
Meow!
As a social practice artist, I sometimes visit schools and lead creative activities with children. Teachers tell the class they must be good listeners. But what is a good listener? Am I a good listener? Listening can be hard to describe or define. It depends on your relationships, your context, your intentions for listening. I'd like my community-based art practice to be open and collaborative. And so surely listening is very important. My name is Hannah Kemp Welsh, and this series is part of my research into listening within social art practice. In these episodes, I speak to socially engaged, community and participatory artists to understand how they listen within their practice, what gets in the way of listening, and what the consequences of listening might be. Episode 2. Edwin Mingard, listening from before there is a project. I met Edwin in 2019 on a year-long artist development program called Constellations. After our working days ended, Edwin would travel up to Stoke-on-Trent to run a project with homeless young people. These late-night trips intrigued me, and when a year later I watched the film he'd made with this group, it was evident that his investment in this project was matched by the participants. It's a magical film. It's co-produced with Care. Edwin's now working on an artist-led research project with young people in a pupil referral unit with support from Chisenhill Gallery. To start us off, could you say a bit about how you describe your practice?
I guess when I describe it to people, I often say that the material that I'm working with is relationship-based. So maybe that's my relationship to a person that I'm collaborating with, or maybe it's our relationship to a wider social structure or society's relationship to a particular issue or, you know, to a particular structure that has come about through nobody particularly directing that it did so. That's the medium. That's the stuff you're sort of working with, sometimes just showing it, sometimes trying to alter it or mess around with it or provoke, you know, ideally a positive change. But you do that through different methods. And so there are physical materials that I work with, but they will differ project to project. And really a lot of the work is about working out which physical medium is most appropriate. It might be that I'm making a work with somebody who is particularly into a particular physical art form. And so we might make work in that way. Or it might be that it's a thing that affects a particular community in a physical geography, and something that can be maybe sculptural and physically happen there is good. Or it might be that it's a thing that affects everybody. And so something like audio or film or a thing that can be shared easily online, you know, with a wider group of people is appropriate. So it sort of depends.
That's interesting to hear how the group that you work with influences the mediums that you work with so profoundly. I was wondering if you could say something about how these projects come about. How are they initiated? Where do they begin?
There are all kinds of difficult ethical things to navigate. One of them is the funding source, for example. So that's why I have worked to make sure that my work is funded by public sources and foundations. The other one is, why is the work funded and where was it initiated from? And there's a sort of big debate about social practice artists essentially being like lower paid care workers or less secure health workers or whatever. And I've felt for a long time that a way to at least mitigate some of the risks of that is to be developing work yourself or with a group of people that you all want to make for its own benefit, and then going off and looking for the funding. You know, I respect artists who do it the other way a lot, but there's a real risk if you're just looking for like who's commissioning what. Okay, these guys want an artist to work with some healthcare workers, cool, I'll invent a project, then there's a risk that you end up falling into, it's not a given, but there's a risk that you end up falling into that category. And I found developing work myself with other people and finding the funding for it later mitigates a lot of that risk. I mean, also in your own right as well, just means you end up with a lot more control over the direction of projects and your own career and that kind of thing as well.
I witnessed you working on a self-initiated project like that in 2018 and onwards when you were working with a group of homeless young people in Stoke-on-Trent, collaborating to produce this film, An Intermission, that came out in 2020. I'm really interested in the process of making that film. I really thought it was a brilliant, brilliant work, and I share it with students when I teach, as you know, as a great example of artist community collaborations that think deeply about power dynamics within these collaborations. Could you say more about those processes, maybe using An Intermission as an example?
Yeah, film's a weird one because, and I'd say, you know, I've made a lot of works that are sort of photographic series as well, and I think they have this a similar issue in that on one level, they're very accessible because most people spend a fair amount of time consuming audiovisual material, you know, watching films, TV shows, YouTube clips, like whatever. So the average person has quite a developed language creatively, whereas I'm not sure you could say the same, for example, about a particular kind, you know, about like abstract painting. You know, it's a privilege to be able to get to spend real time with certain art forms as a viewer. And then other things we're used to seeing in a maybe less arts way, but it's, you know, still the same stuff. Like we're used to watching, you know, and like a music video is moments away from being an artist film when it's good as well. So I feel like people have this really developed language. And so I really like that about film, that there's a level to which it's so accessible. And so when we're making stuff, it's that understanding of the rules behind what you're doing and that people have that is so important. So you can film something together and then someone else can just say like, oh, it looks rubbish, you know, or like wow, it's like turned out how I wanted, like they already had a picture of it in their head. Whereas I feel like, you know, say we'd been making a temporary sculpture, I'm not sure that everybody would have had a reference point for that. So I really like that about it. On the other hand, probably the majority of people have access to the means to make video, like just through the phone in their pocket. But very, very few people have access to making images of the kind of quality that you could put on a cinema screen in a film festival or, you know, in a big public art gallery and for it to like look great. And I think there's something really nice about the way that working on film is like, nobody can do that on their own. I can't make those, even though I know what I'm doing, I can't make those quality of images on my own. It needs a team of people, you know, maybe a couple of you operating the camera, you know, maybe somebody, you know, running the schedule, somebody else recording the sound, people running around with lights and that kind of stuff. Has a level of practical collaboration baked into it. But at the same time, they're all things that I think are really easy to learn. You know, I can teach somebody in 5 minutes, like how to operate a industry standard lighting setup, and they can do like a decent job. Like I can show somebody in 5 minutes how to hold a boom and work a Zoom and whatever. And, you know, and maybe someone who gets paid hundreds a day to do that can do it better, but, you know, they can probably do an okay job, probably as good as I can. So that practical, necessitating practical collaboration, again, I really like. But then there's a third level, which is that if you say to somebody, you know, we're going to make this sort of work that has no shape and structure, but it's going to be about this difficult social, personal, political thing, that sounds really imposing. But if you say to someone, we're going to make a film, hey, can you hold this? Like, you know, we need someone to record sound. Let me show you the buttons. Can you do that? Then that's the thing without emotional investment, you can do pretty quickly. And then before you know it, you're just collaborating with a group of people. And then those conversations about like, what are we going to say? How are we going to say it? Can happen amongst the group who are actually already collaborating and who already have a degree of trust. and where people already feel valuable because they've already demonstrated that they're useful. Yeah, I think it's a useful medium for collaboration in those ways.
I really hear that. But do you think it's possible to make those collaborative practices like truly equitable?
I think they have to be, because if you go into those things with, you know, with a really regimented plan, say it's a circumstance where you're the professional, you know, artist, i.e. artwork pays your bills, and you're working with somebody who that's not true of, then like they probably didn't come into it with like a written plan and five other projects experience to draw on. You know, they will totally have an agenda and a view and all the rest of it, but if you want to be equals, then you have to sort of approach it as equals. And you know, when you're sitting down and making a plan, maybe the person you're working with should be involved in that. I have this like principle when I make work that if I'm collaborating with somebody else to make a piece of work, we should only ever be making a piece of work that neither of us can make on our own. If it's a piece of work that I can have just made on my own, then I'm wasting somebody else's time and I could just go off and do that. If it's a piece of work that the person I'm collaborating with could have just made on their own, like don't commission me, like just commission them and, you know, they can do it. And so when we collaborate, it should be a thing that, yeah, that neither of us could have done on our own. And that means I have to be bringing something to the table that's useful. And maybe that is like a particular artistic sensibility that is, you know, unique to me, or maybe it's practical experience of having done that thing a few times, or maybe it's arts adjacent kind of technical experience, like how to work a camera and how to think about how we frame shots, or some knowledge about what some construction will look like when it's finished. And then the person I'm working with will likewise just bring a whole load of, you know, maybe it's something that's around like their personal experience, like sort of lived experience, as it commonly gets called, or maybe it's about, I often think it's more than that, actually. It's like lived experiences, I sometimes feel like it's a bit of a patronizing term. And really what it is that if you have that lived experience, you have like unique insights that some random artist wading in would never have. And probably, almost definitely, the political actor who's devising the policy that affects that issue, they don't have, like they don't have maybe the granular understanding from the ground, or maybe it's that they don't understand how that feels, like, you know, the effect of a government policy, like what that feels like to be on the receiving end of it. I guess they're just broad examples of expertise we might both have, but obviously that person might also be like an amazing painter and we're going to make this work as a series of paintings. It could be anything. You both bring those things and then you sit down and you, you know, and you work out, okay, what could this project be? Like with all of the resources that we can each bring to the table, like what could this project be? And then it's from then on, it's like a collaborative like discussion.
I can really hear that dialogue is central to this practice. I also get a sense that there's a listening beyond that dialogue.
It's kind of the most central thing, really, when you think about it. It's sort of, and it runs right through from before there's like a project to, you know, long after the project is over. You know, it's sort of, it's absolutely crucial, especially when, you know, like we were talking about a moment ago about, you know, a potential power imbalance that has to be managed. You know, you'll pick up signs of those things before they're a problem if you're listening. It's really right from the inception of a project. It's like, how could there be a project without just really a lot of listening? Like, for example, if there's an issue that I read about, it's not affecting me personally, I'm reading about it in the news, or maybe it's affecting a friend or a friend of a friend, you know, and maybe it's something like a civil rights injustice, or it's like a shitty government policy or whatever. I come across somebody who is affected by that, you know, and I'm like, you know, like an artist, it's like when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I'm like, maybe we could make a piece of art about this. And I have no idea what that would look like or what direction to head in at all. And you work that out through discussion, but really, you know, listening, like in the very early stages, talking about it and just being like, what is this thing actually like? You know, what is it? sort of feel like? What does it look like? And also, I'm an artist and I was going to propose we make an artwork about it. Sort of what, sort of how would you feel about that? And really listening, not going in being like, I'm going to ask and I need someone to say, okay. Like really, when I proposed that, did they seem like they were really up for that and it was a cool a thing they'd love to do? Or did they seem like they'd maybe do it if I pushed? Because that's not right. So it's important in that way. But I would say sort of right the way through. So this one, this thing that really sort of stuck with me for a while is when I was making the film in Stoke, I'd always thought that the difference between me and someone who is experiencing homelessness is that I have a house and they don't. Like, you know, it's like a rented room in a shared house, but it's a safe, warm space I just have access to, and somebody else doesn't. And that's a massive social injustice. And I learned very quickly that that wasn't the case from listening to other people talk about their experience of having a house and not having a house. But there was this one specific thing that really stuck with me. And it was when Adam was finally given like a flat by the council, and he was in the most horrendous circumstances and was, you know, had to really, really fight for it, and was, you know, finally given this flat, and he got the keys and called me up and was just like, it's amazing. I've got the keys right now. And we went round, like a group of us, everyone in the group except me was still not in a position where they had like a house. We went round and they asked Adam questions that I never would have thought to have asked, and like just such insightful things. And there was a moment where I was just watching back later, like, you know, material on my own, you know, we'd done a little edit together, and I was watching back one of those bits, and Mel just goes to Adam, like, do you ever get lonely now that you've got a house? And he looks at the camera and he like goes, no, because I have like FaceTime on my phone. So if I get lonely, I just FaceTime people. And it was like, wow, fuck, like he's lonely. It's a big thing. And from that point forward, I just like, Adam would have been the person you're like, okay, I'm not worried about Adam anymore. Like things are on the right track. But I just made a point of like calling him every week and just sort of having a chat. And we still do that, like, you know, less frequently, but we still do that to this day. That was like 2 or 3 years ago. And it was like, I'd have missed that. Like he was telling me something. It was only like Mel who'd have thought to ask that. Like it wouldn't have even occurred to me, but she knew what it would be like now he wasn't in a shelter maybe with a bunch of other people, or he wasn't roving around the streets with a bunch of other teenagers. Yeah. And so it's so important. And that example, I think, makes clear I'm not good at it, like that I'm learning. I don't know. It's like a central part of making the work.
And she was able to hear because of her particular sort of positionality.
Yeah, no, I think it's, you know, there's a bit in that film where those guys talk about the experience of motherhood. And I sort of got them to interview each other, basically. And it's like, it's just a recognition of like expertise of like, I am not qualified to do this and you are. I'll like press record, you're in charge of the questions. And also just checking in on someone else and like, maybe we need to stop talking about this, or maybe it's a thing they really want to say, you know, that you have had the same experience and you'll know. Just recognition of expertise.
On that note of expertise, I'm kind of interested in this idea of listening expertise. Have you got any thoughts on that?
Totally. We've never been taught. And we also live in a society where so many impulses you get, you're sort of fed from outside, are like sort of be on broadcast mode. Like, you know, that's what most of social media is about. It's sort of as artists where you need to like get your work seen and get commissioned by things, whatever. It's like there's a lot of things pushing you into being in constant broadcast mode. And at the same time, when you make the kind of work that we do, it's not about that at all. You know, personally, I'm very proud to not be good at the broadcast thing. Like, I don't want to get good at it. But the listening thing, yeah, we've just never been taught. And, you know, we're trying to work it out. Although I also think, you know, maybe there are things, you know, that you can teach somebody that would really improve things, and I'd be up for that. I also think there's something about not professionalizing that, about it being a thing that, you know, we're just working through, you know, together, like when you're working with other people on a project and, you know, you're working out how to communicate together and make sure everyone's happy. Like there's something real and human about it. Like you don't go in with like totally developed listening exercise that makes the act of listening feel like you're working. It's like you're listening because you genuinely care.
Ways of Listening is a series for Meanwhile in an Abandoned Warehouse, a podcast about cultural democracy in community art. Show notes with links to the projects discussed are available at meow.net. This episode was recorded and produced by Hannah Kemp-Welsh.